Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Leah Recco of the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. I'm very happy now to welcome Chip Duncan. He's a documentary filmmaker, photographer, and author of the new book, Enough to Go Around, Searching for Hope in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. And he will be in Santa Fe on Friday, this Friday, October 9th, from 5 to 6 in the evening at Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So you were in Ethiopia on 9/11/2001, an unusual place for an American to be, and you started, after having been, and you still are, a documentary filmmaker, on a path that led you to a whole other creative outlet, which was still photography. And there's a wonderful story that you tell in your book of a man named Abraham Bongasi and what you learned from him. I was wondering if you would tell us that story.
Well, yeah, I'd love to. And you're right. Certainly on 9/11, everybody's got their own story, and mine put me in the middle of Addis Ababa. I was working on a film for public television, and one of my tasks was to head down to the Oromia region in southern Ethiopia. And I was documenting the work being done there by a group called Save the Children. And their field director, Abraham Bongasi, and I were out in the field for several days. We were covering everything from family planning initiatives to immunizations and food distribution, the whole gamut of humanitarian work there. And I had an interesting experience. One day we stopped for lunch, and it's a nomadic region, and there's people walking or traveling on some kind of livestock almost everywhere. And we stopped for lunch, and Abraham and his crew had a small basket of sandwiches, and we all got our little sandwich, and we were standing by the cars eating, and a gentleman came walking by, and in a very simple gesture, Abraham just ripped his sandwich in half and handed half of it to the guy that was walking by. And the interesting thing for me, it sounds so simple, but the guy wasn't begging. And what was more interesting was Abraham didn't even seem particularly conscious of being generous in that moment. And it coincided with a number of expeditions I'd done to Peru. I had always been fascinated by the word Aini, which is a Quechua word. And Aini had been explained to me as sharing, but it also meant something much more than sharing. And in the moment when Abraham shared his sandwich, it occurred to me that Aini means sharing without thinking about sharing. In other words, it's not paying it forward, because paying it forward implies that you're going to get something back. This word means that you share just as a natural human action. And so even though I was several thousand miles from Peru, I watched this gentleman share his sandwich without thinking about it, and the word Aini came to mind. And so for the first time, I had a definition for that word. And I think it's a beautiful way for someone to live their life, to find a way to share without having to think about what they're getting in return.
It's very humbling, because I think in the culture in which we live here in the United States, those who are generous can get into this mindset of being proud of themselves. And this is far beyond that.
It's way beyond that, because what I found in that moment was that there really are cultures in the world where they're not paying it forward. They literally, sharing is just a natural act. It's just part of what they do. And all the work I'd done in Peru, I tried to get my head around that word. It's a Quechua word, Aini. And the shaman that I would work with would say, well, it's like sharing, but it's something greater. And just that simple human interaction of, you know, a guy walking by and you just naturally share something with him. And certainly he wasn't thinking, what am I going to get back? There's nothing to get back. And he didn't know the gentleman. He was just a guy walking down, you know, a very dusty, dirty road in the southern part of Ethiopia. So it's not exactly the way we go about charitable giving here in the United States.
So how did you then find yourself in Afghanistan? The book covers Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Sudan, and I think Afghanistan was your first stop of those three.
Yeah, I worked with Abraham for a couple more days, and another fellow named Mike Speaks, who was with me, and then we couldn't get out of Ethiopia for several weeks, so we finished our work in Ethiopia, and then I was so inspired by both the work that Save the Children was doing, but also this whole idea of giving back without expectation. And I thought, well, I'm just going to start volunteering for whatever NGO would have me, and I'll do what I do, which is document, tell stories. And I called Save the Children, and it wasn't long after that that I was that I volunteered for them in Afghanistan in 2005. And it's very different to go to Afghanistan with an NGO. We didn't have armed security. We drove all over the country in a couple of 4x4s. So my experience of Afghanistan is very different from, say, the military's experience or the experience of, say, a State Department worker who never leaves Kabul. And then from that moment forward, I worked with Save the Children. Then I worked with Relief International on a similar mission after the earthquake in Pakistan, and then in Darfur as recently as last January. So January of 08, that is. And a number of people were fascinated by the work, and I thought, well, I'll just write a book, see what comes of it.
You started doing still photography after having been a documentary filmmaker as your main work, and it's an interesting contrast that you set up, how different those two kinds of images are, taking moving images and taking still images. On the one hand, the moving image is a lot more intrusive because you have to be there with a crew and lights and sound and all sorts of things. But on the other hand, the still image is a lot more intimate. You have people looking at the camera, which you really never have in a movie. Tell us about that transition and what it was like to be a still photographer.
Well, I've been shooting motion pictures as a documentary filmmaker for roughly 25 years. So I know the nuances of that. I know how to move the camera. I know how to sequence. I know how music or narration or sound effects might impact an image in a finished film. And what I enjoyed about the process of moving to stills is, for the first time, I would be interacting with someone who could literally be inches away or feet away from me. And so a lot of times my interactions were much more personal, and they involved a level of trust that I wouldn't have found otherwise. And so the trust factor, I think, became significant.
One of the things that I found so interesting is that when you go into a place where not a lot of Westerners have been before, and people regard you with, I mean, at the very least, a sense of unfamiliarity or perhaps mistrust, the way you break the ice is with the children.
Yeah, I find that, it's interesting because a lot of people don't navigate the world because of fear. They have all kinds of fear, and walls go up, and if you're not willing to go to certain places, you never find out that that really life is fairly similar no matter where you go. And in particular, I always find that my relationship with kids is strong. They're curious about the cameras. They're curious about the equipment I have. And the minute there's kids around, fear just goes out the window. So, in addition to the book that we're talking about, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Darfur, I've been working a lot in the Kibera slum in Nairobi. And it takes me 2 minutes to be in the slum working, and all of a sudden I'll have 10 or 15 kids trailing me around. And, we will a lot of times not speak the same language, so I might wind up using pantomime. I always ask when I can take a still photo. And so frequently I'll break the ice by, because I'm using digital cameras now, I'll break the ice by showing them the images I'm taking. I'll snap funny photos and then show them the images on the screen. So before I ever get to the more serious or more artistic images, I've already established some kind of relationship, frequently with kids, sometimes with mothers and children. That was not really the case in Afghanistan because of the cultural differences around the way the Taliban in particular treated women. But a lot of times I'll break the ice with kids and depends on which culture it is and what's going on. Sometimes the danger factor might be ramped up, and it's not possible to do that.
There is this whole question of women, and you talk about that throughout the book here and there, but in Afghanistan, you saw very clearly how second-class citizens women and girls really were, and the importance, if you're going to have a functional society, of empowering women and girls. What was it like there?
In Afghanistan in particular?
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly degrees of patriarchy, and certainly the United States has its own elements of patriarchy. So, we can look at the glass ceiling here and have issues around it and discussions about it. In Afghanistan, it's still very, very different from anything I've experienced in the West. A lot of that has to do with the way the Taliban ruled when they were in power. It was probably one of the worst regimes for women that we've seen in the late 20th century, early 21st century. Obviously, women were subjugated in all kinds of ways, including the way they dress, not allowed to show their face, that sort of thing. By the time I got there in 05, the war had been going on long enough that you would find certain villages or certain valleys where things had changed enough that women might appear without the burqa or, in some cases, even without covering their head. Mostly in the north is where I found that. The further south or southeast I got, the more they fell back into much more patriarchal customs based on the Taliban. But it is changing, and it's continuing to change today. I mean, the notion of educating women and girls is probably the single most important thing that we can do as a society here or globally. You see that I was first exposed to it in Ethiopia in terms of the work that Save the Children was doing there. All of it was geared towards empowering women, empowering girls. Women, frankly, just do a much better job of taking care of finances, taking care of the house, much safer when it comes to microloans. So it's, the systems are being implanted in Afghanistan. I was north of Kabul, about 60, 70 miles north of Kabul. While I was there, I went to the opening of a school where girls were allowed to go to school for the first time since the fall of the Taliban. And I can't even really describe the emotion that went along with that, not just in the crowd or with the kids, but also the emotional experience I had while filming it. You see empowerment in a whole different way.
We're talking to Chip Duncan. His new book is called Enough to Go Around, Searching for Hope in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. And it's full of just incredibly beautiful color images. And as you say in the book, color photographs, you weren't looking to, even in these war-torn regions, and Lord knows Afghanistan has been dealing with war and conflict for a really long time, even in these regions, you are looking for and finding the humanity and the kind of everyday nature of people. And it seems they really opened up to you in that way.
Well, I think if there's... the book works on a lot of levels, and I hope people will take the time to come out to Garcia Street this week or just, go onto our website and look at the images that are available there. But the message that comes through in terms of the still photography, I think, is that there's a humanity to the images. I did not go out of my way to look for the menacing, the dark, the tragic. One of my problems with a lot of the way foreign policy has been conducted since 9/11 is that we built up walls around Islam. We started to, as a society, we started to fear people who considered themselves Muslim. And to me, it's just wrong. And we have, stereotypes about all kinds of things that are wrong. But in the case of the book, I went out of my way to try and break down those stereotypes. So when you see pictures of women, oftentimes it's an image that just portrays enormous amounts of love between mother and child, the same love you would see if you were in Tulsa or Santa Fe or Northern California. It's, mother-child love is an obvious expression, and there's a lot of images like that, but there's also a number of images of Muslim men, particularly in Afghanistan, where they're smiling and precocious and curious and funny. And so suddenly all the walls that people have come down when they see those images. It's like, oh, that's a person I can relate to. That's a person I could share a cup of tea with. And I think that's important, and it's something that words don't do very well. I mean, I could write about a smiling Muslim man, and it doesn't do the same thing as seeing the same, like in particular, an image of a carpet seller that's on the back cover of the book at a carpet shop in Mazar Sharif, and he's just beaming with smiles, and you suddenly go, oh, this is a person I can relate to. It doesn't matter that he's Afghani or Muslim. He's somebody who I would enjoy buying a carpet from.
Exactly.
Or having a cup of tea with.
And I have to say, I would look at these images and think, wow, that one looks like one of my uncles. And there's definitely a universality that probably everybody can relate to. And when you just said, this is somebody I'd like to share a cup of tea with, that was part of what you did. When you would go to a new place, you'd find the local official and share a cup of tea. And that was another way of getting in and getting to know people.
Well, yeah, and to give a plug for Greg Mortensen's book, Three Cups of Tea, I think he does a marvelous job of expressing the importance of having tea, which is, in the case of my experience, it's almost like a metaphor for respect and for listening and for taking the time to say, you're important to me. I don't need to be self-absorbed. I want to hear your story. I want to, you know, all too often I think it's a phenomenon of the West, maybe because of our affluence or because of our technologies or our communications, that we tend to look at the developing world and think, you know, I can really teach them something, when in fact that's possible, but it's also possible that they can teach us something. And I think that's a much more interesting and dynamic and oftentimes better way to interact with another culture, which is to sit, have a cup of tea, and listen and ask interesting questions that let them tell you about them versus us just saying, oh, I know what's wrong here and I'm going to fix it.
You then went to Pakistan, and as you write about, the huge earthquake there that happened actually... It was October 8th. It was exactly 4 years ago today that there was this huge earthquake that did not give, did not get the media coverage or the international response that the tsunami did. Tell us about that and then what you saw.
Well, it was kind of an interesting thing that happened. I had been to Afghanistan for Save the Children, and then I was working on a film project in Los Angeles, and I went to a party reception. And while I was there, I started speaking with a guy named Salman Naqvi. And Salman is a doctor, lives in Southern California. He heard I'd been to Afghanistan, and he said, would you consider going to Pakistan? And I said, sure, why? He said, well, to document the damage front and the relief efforts associated with the earthquake. And the funny thing was, I'd heard about the earthquake, and I had paid very little attention to it. It had happened only about a month earlier at the time I met him. And we got into a discussion, and what was fascinating was that the entire planet responded incredibly and very generously to right after the tsunami that hit the Indian Ocean and many of the countries surrounding the Indian Ocean. So we were all very familiar with it. It was a big media phenomenon. And then right after that, Hurricane Katrina happened, and the same sort of thing, a great outpouring of support and great media coverage. By the time the Pakistan earthquake happened, I think the phenomenon that I've heard is that there was donor fatigue, that people there had been so much calamity and so much natural disaster that people just simply didn't respond. I think that may be true. I think there might also be some truth to the fact that it was in Pakistan and that there may have been some biases around, you know, giving money to Pakistan. But regardless of the reasons, the Pakistan earthquake was, relatively speaking, it was ignored by the rest of the world, and yet it was a phenomenal tragedy. Roughly 80,000 people were killed. Roughly 2 million people were left homeless. And so, as strange as it sounds, at this cocktail party in Los Angeles, I meet a doctor from Pakistan, or of Pakistan origin anyway, who says, you know, have you been there? Can we go? And I immediately said yes. And he was on the board of another nonprofit group called Relief International. So they're very successful in Pakistan. So I went on behalf of Relief International. We put together a lot of media based on relief efforts that were going on there post-earthquake, and came back and then raised money for, essentially in the case of Relief International, we were raising money for a livestock program for women who had been widowed during the earthquake and had also lost their livelihoods. And it involved microloans and any number of other programs, but it was very successful. I then joined the board of Relief International and then most recently went and documented their work in Darfur, Sudan.
It's really striking how amazing the work of these people who are members of relief organizations, humanitarian aid organizations, how incredible their work is. They're people who do so much, put themselves in danger, get very little out of it. In a way, they're practicing this Aini that you talked about, the Quechua word, at the beginning. And you talk about how it's really for them not about political engagement or action, things like that, but just being there where they're needed.
Well, I do. In fact, I think one of the readers who provided a cover quote for the book, Danny Glover, talked in particular about his response to the book had a lot to do with what humanitarian aid is and what the humanitarian aid worker is like. And he liked the portrayal of that. And I think what comes through the writing in the book, even certainly more than the photos in this case, is that these are people who are motivated by very altruistic things. Certainly the idea of the NGO, the non-governmental organization, is a big idea, and there can be enormous differences from one NGO to another. I happen to join the board of Relief International because I believe in what they're doing, and most of the donations that they receive go into the field. But I will say across the board, most of the humanitarian aid workers that I've interacted with, beginning with Abraham Bangasi and then on through these various missions, they're not doing it for the money. They're not doing it for the lifestyle. And by that, I mean the conditions that they are existing in on a day-to-day basis are often very rugged. The food is not necessarily good. The security is the best that can be provided under very difficult circumstances. So sometimes that means that they're working in the middle of a genocide or a war zone. And they're really operating on ideals that I think a lot of us could easily operate on right here at home. It doesn't, you know, it may seem to some people incredibly glamorous or incredibly stupid, I don't know, for, you know, to go to a place like Darfur and work. But I always tell people, you can do it right here. You know, you can hook up with a Boys and Girls Club. You can hook up with, you know, through your synagogue or your church or your mosque or any number of things and do the same kind of work right here. You know, it's just about volunteering and getting out and saying, what can I do to help? And what can I do to understand your situation better and build bridges from, you know, one culture to another, one race to another? It can all be done here. I happen to think that the aid workers that I've encountered, you know, would be successful operating in almost any culture. They're open-minded, they're non-judgmental as a rule, and willing to put the concept of Aini into their daily lives, which means they don't always get a whole sandwich. Sometimes they only get a half a sandwich.
We're talking to Chip Duncan. The book is called Enough to Go Around, Searching for Hope in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. Well, let's talk about Darfur. How did you end up there? You were in Kenya during a time where it was not a really great time to be in Kenya.
Well, I volunteered to go to Darfur for Relief International. And, you know, volunteering means, generally it means I'm paying my own way. And I decided to go in conjunction with a film trip I was taking to Kenya. I'm working on a screenplay, a movie project on a photographer named Mohamed Amin, a great African photographer who documented the 1984 Ethiopian famine that then led to We Are the World and Live Aid, and it's a fairly, his images are quite famous. And so I was going to Kenya to work on a film about him, I thought, well, I'll do that, and then I'll take a couple of weeks on my own and head over to Darfur, because obviously once I'm in Nairobi, it's going to be cheaper. What happened that was so interesting was I got to Nairobi on New Year's Eve of what would have been 07, transitioning into 08, and the Kenyan government had just had a presidential election, and the results were in dispute, and the nation was in turmoil. And I made it in on one of KLM's last flights into Nairobi and found myself, you know, I'd mentally prepared to go to Darfur, and I was thinking Nairobi would just be a cakewalk. I'd been there before. I know a lot of people there. I thought, well, I love Nairobi. It'll be fun. As it turned out, Nairobi was quite dangerous at the time I got there. I spent a few days with journalists in Nairobi documenting what was going on. Then I flew to Darfur and spent my time in a village, actually quite a large city now, called El Fasher in North Darfur, and then eventually made it back to Nairobi and spent a couple weeks back in Nairobi documenting the riots that were happening there. Darfur, as many of your listeners probably know, has been experiencing what has been called by President Bush and others a genocide. And it's an interesting thing. I would urge your listeners to go to the UN Charter on Genocide and read what the term means and come to their own conclusions. Suffice it to say that my definition would be that they are experiencing a genocide, and the numbers of people who have been dead, certainly the killed, and certainly the number of women who've been raped, the number of people who've been left homeless is extraordinary. And so, you know, the estimates are 200,000 to 400,000 people have been killed. Millions are homeless. And in this case, they wound up being relocated in large part to what are called IDP camps or refugee camps in different parts of Sudan. And a lot of the camps it's hard to say who's administering any particular camp. But a lot of times the NGO community is working in those camps to provide shelter, to provide food, to provide health care. I went to a camp just south of El Fasher, which is in North Darfur. It was called Zamzam. And there were roughly 40,000 displaced people in the camp at the time I got there, and another 600 or so were arriving every week. So quite a desperate place, difficult to find anything particularly hopeful there, except that no one's given up, and people are still trying. Kids are still kids. You know, a lot of the things that I talk about in the book relative to family life and the things that we find important in life are just the same in an IDP refugee camp in Darfur as they would be anywhere else.
Reading all three sections of the book, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur, it reminds one that the basic things that make structures that make life work are, in fact, health clinics and water and food. And when I think about the healthcare debate that we're talking about now, those things are so incredibly important and basic, and providing those is the difference between peace and war in some cases. What was it, the quote that you had at the beginning, we are three meals away from anarchy?
Oh, yeah. I started the book that way. I mean, I had heard that quote somewhere. I'd love to attribute it. I don't know who first said it, but the quote is that America's three meals away from anarchy. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. We've become accustomed to a certain level of privilege in the United States that that many of the people in disadvantaged parts of the world don't experience. And so, you know, it's true, certainly true in a camp like Zamzam camp in Darfur.
It's hard to, you make an attempt in the book, and as you say yourself, it's hard to really give a brief history of the Darfur conflict because it's so convoluted, and it's really, we like, I think, to say these are the good guys and these are the bad guys, but it's so crazy there that one almost wonders whether it's that weird phenomenon of bloodlust just taking on a life of its own, fighting just because you're fighting. I mean, what did that look like? Did you come close to that yourself?
Well, first of all, I have to compliment you for reading the book, for really reading the book, because your listeners may not know this, but a lot of interviewers don't, and I'm really grateful that you did. And so what you're talking about, I think, if I were to describe it, I would say that there's a common denominator among all three of the nations I cover in the book. And again, the funny thing is I didn't set out to write a book about these three places. I experienced them, and then I wrote the book. But one of the common denominators is that they were all British colonies. And I'm not here to go off on Britain in particular, but part of what happened with colonialization is that the foreign power came in, took over the country, and then at the point in time where they left, they appointed new people to power. And so what's interesting in particular in Sudan is that Sudan has a fairly mixed race, multi-ethnic population. And at the time the British pulled out, they empowered essentially empowered the north, which was the Arab population. And so today you have a central government in Sudan that is largely of Arab descent. And the fighting that's gone on in South Sudan since the time of the British pullout has been largely between people of African tribal descent and Arab descent in the north. And that conflict, what's called the essentially a civil war in South Sudan, has been going on for a very long time. And so when you start looking at what are the roots of the genocide in North Darfur, which geographically is located somewhat central and west of South Sudan, when you look at that conflict, it's difficult, I think, to just generalize it and say it's a genocide, because that would you know, take all kinds of other factors out of it. There are battles over natural resources because Sudan is very resource rich. There are battles over power related back to the time of colonization. What makes it a genocide by the UN definition has a lot to do with the way the Arab-backed government has taken on taken the conflict to people of African descent, and in the case, many of your listeners may have heard of the Janjaweed, which is the definition is somewhat disputed. Some people say men on horseback, some people say devils on horseback. But the idea is that the Janjaweed have been trying to essentially exterminate, which is why it qualifies as genocide. And so there's a lot of things going on there. I can't answer your question about bloodlust specifically because, no, I didn't spend long enough there, nor did I specifically see that. But certainly what's happening there and also in many other parts of the world is that the conflict has gone on for so long that a lot of times people don't know anything but conflict. And that's certainly true in Afghanistan. I mean, the conflict's been going on, you know, since the mid to late 70s. So, you know, if you grow up in that and you're 30 years old and you've never known anything but conflict, it's certainly going to impact your worldview.
The book is called Enough to Go Around, Searching for Hope in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. And its author, Chip Duncan, photographer and documentary filmmaker, will be at Garcia Street Books tomorrow, Friday, October 9th, from 5 to 6 in the afternoon, doing a book signing. That's on Garcia Street in Santa Fe. And I just want to say, I found the book so moving with that combination of text and images, which speak of a real sense of connection. And as we talked about, there is this sense that it must come from you, the photographer, feeling this way, but the sense that these people are almost your relatives. There is that basic attitude of treating all people with just friendly and open respect that comes through in the pictures as well as the text. And I just want to thank you so much for sharing this with all of us.
Well, I'm really grateful that you took the time with the book. I hope your listeners will do the same, and I'll look forward to meeting anybody that comes over to the bookstore.
We'll see you at Garcia Street tomorrow at 5.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you. And you can find out more about Chip Duncan at duncanentertainment.com. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Leah Recco. She is the director of the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe, and she's the curator of a show that is opening tomorrow night at the CCA called Mapping a Green Future. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So yesterday we talked to the people from Vision Shift, which is happening at all over the city, six different locations, one of which is the CCA. But this is its own exhibition, which you curated. Tell us about the impetus for this and what's in the show.
Well, the impetus was my interest in mapping and John Fogarty's interest in the green future that he can envisage. And so together we came up with this idea of a show that was a group show with artists from the West and East Coasts and the Southwest area who had an interest in collaborative, cross-disciplinary, eco-centered art practices and that we're also familiar with land use policy in the area.
And so what kind of things showed up? I mean, that intersection between mapping and art can be a very interesting one.
Well, Andrea Polly and Chuck Varga have been working with data-generating processes for a long time, and they've installed a permanent installation at CCA, which is a weather station that generates data that has value outside of the arts community.
Namely, the weather,
and it feeds into data banks that are actually used for data interpretation for the climate. They're also putting in a data-gathering cloud car, which is essentially belching out large amounts of steam from the car and drawing attention to, you know, life with the automobile. So that will be stationed directly outside the gallery. We have 13 artists in this show, and all of them are working in different ways. We're exhibiting Basha Ehlin's Gathering of Waters project, which is three of her five river projects, one that goes from the source to the Gulf of Mexico, from Colorado to the Gulf of Mexico along the Rio Grande, where she had hundreds of participants all hand vials of water downstream. So she kind of formed a human river, and she's really interested in mapping healthy watersheds, and she believes that there's a kind of an integration with communities to be able to ensure the sustainability of those watersheds. So that's a couple of the artists in the show. There's, as I said, there's 13. We're also showing the Dreaming New Mexico project from the Bioneers, and we're showing work by Brooke Singer, which is something called Superfund 365, where she's mapped 365 Superfund sites across the US on a journey from New York City to Hawaii. And then we have Beatrice DaCosta's work, where she uses homing pigeons that are enabled with wireless GPS devices that collect electronic air pollution data and send it back in kind of a real-time scenario. So it's a social public experiment between humans and pigeons. Then we have Bill Gilbert's series of Walking the Grid. So he tries to, you know, walk these abstract representations of the land, and he's also using GIS technology to do that.
What is GIS?
Geographic Interface Systems. And really what it does is, like, it's very similar to a GPS in a way. So he uses that to figure out where he is and how to map it as he walks these kind of arbitrary lines that don't make any sense.
So these are all in interesting ways, interpretations of mapping in non-traditional ways. I mean, I love maps, and I used to collect maps a little bit, not super expensive ones or anything, but just how the United States was thought to look 100 years ago, 200, 300 years ago, or strange maps of the world which aren't accurate anymore. And maps have always this feeling of accuracy, but it's not necessarily true.
Right. They're really propositions. They're really arguments for what the belief system you want them to be, you know, the belief system that's trying to be overlaid through them.
Right.
So I've always enjoyed maps as well, because I traversed the globe so much for 10 or 12 years. Pretty much all I did was had a map and a backpack and travelled. So my walls, wherever I stayed, were always covered with maps. And this is kind of, I guess, where my love of maps generated from. But I also recognise the danger in just accepting that information. So I am interested in working with these kind of alternative artistic and interdisciplinary models of mapping.
We're talking to Leah Recco, director of the CCA. Mapping a Green Future is the exhibition, which opens tomorrow at 5 in the evening at the CCA. There is such an interesting and growing intersection between art and ecological studies. There is, I guess at UNM, I didn't even know this, an art and ecology department?
Right. And that's now headed by Catherine Harris, who's also in the show, and she's doing a very interesting project about the flow of water as it would come from the watershed through the gallery. The art and ecology department at UNM, I think, is very interesting. It's got a lot of good people working in it. It's just an emerging program that's just been founded, I guess, really by Bill Gilbert, or he was quite seminal in its founding. And Basha Eland was also very important in that movement to get this off the ground. I don't really know the ins and outs of the politics of it in that sense, but I do support it. I think it's a terrific program. I think it's a really progressive way of looking at this emerging movement within an institutional system. And I'm hoping that I can work more with that department at CCA and create, I guess, curriculums that the students can work on using CCA as a real-world client.
I guess when you talk about mapping an ecologically sound and sustainable future, the role of creative arts is something that has yet to be explored fully, but it's a very important one, because that's what artists are best at, is really visioning and thinking about things in new creative ways.
Right, and I think that the role of art now is really changing a lot, quite dramatically, and probably more than it has in a long time, and that the arts are now, because of that, they're able to come together more in real-world situations as, you know, as design facilitators and as problem solvers in a way that encompasses more than just an economy of an ecological status, to really provide a more holistic approach to solving these kinds of climate change issues and whatever the issues are that they're dealing with, ecological issues. And I think it's really an important program to be promoting in all the institutions, so I hope that this flourishes here.
You have a vision of the CCA as a self-sustaining and really ecologically sustainable and inspirational place.
Well, I see it as this really amazing campus that, you know, there's a lot of things horribly wrong with it. You know, it needs weatherizing. It's completely energy inefficient. It runs off the PNM coal plants up in Four Corners. And it has all this tremendous potential. I mean, it has runoff issues. It has all these issues, but all these issues are really solvable. You know, it could all be green roofed, it could all be weatherized, it could all run off solar and wind, it could all be a community garden that was powered on its own runoff.
So you've got a lot of land there.
It's great, and it's all really usable. It's not toxic. It's a space for the community, and it could be by the community. So I see it as this tremendous opportunity, and that was kind of really the seed of this mapping show. Came from that idea primarily. Wouldn't CCA be great, a great sustainable model? I think if the economic climate was a little different, we could actually entice kind of commercial entities to showcase their, you know, solar panel initiatives or whatever there. And I think this is a difficult time, but in the future, I would hope that we can make CCA this showcase, because building a green building is a great thing, but we also have to deal with all the existing buildings that we have. And often, building a new building is not only resource draining in itself, but it's not economically viable. It's still a very expensive proposition. So it would be great to use CCA as this guinea pig. It really is kind of my guinea pig in that sense. That's the vision that I would like to see it become.
You are asking the questions that a lot of people are asking, which is, how do I deal with the house I'm living in now or the apartment I'm living in now? I'm not going to go build an earth ship in the hills because I can't afford it and I don't want to anyhow. What do I do with what I have?
Right, exactly. Yeah, at least for this show, we're trying to, thanks to Tyler Rogers, we're hoping to power some of our exhibits off solar energy. So it's a small step for us, but hopefully one that, you know, we can be reiterated in the future as time goes by.
Leah, tell us more about the upcoming Bioneers event. It's October, it's the next weekend, October 16th through 18th, Friday through Sunday. There are going to be screenings of movies, including all sorts of very well-known people, including Michael Pollan and Andrew Weil and so on. And this is happening in the Cinematheque, the movie theater.
The Bioneers host their conference every year in California, and every year they send out satellites to different towns. And we're lucky enough that they agreed to donate us a satellite feed for this year. And so we're able to host that conference via satellite. And I believe it has around 12,000 people that actually attend in California. And so it's a really important eco-conference, and it deals with all kinds of issues. As I'm sure you're aware, you know, Bioneers deals with everything from sustainability to transportation to food production, food security, which is what they're starting to deal with now. And they're really community-oriented. Their Dreaming New Mexico exhibit that we're hosting at the CCA seeks to reconcile nature and cultures at a state level. And the Bioneers Conference generally, I think, means to do that on a global level. And they seek systemic collaborative approaches to the common vision of restoration. So it's a really terrific project. And their centerpiece that they're working from is all about a mapping project. And it's a project called Future Maps, directed by Peter Warshall, who's a biologist and anthropologist and author. And it's all based around the idea of the age of renewables. I'm sure most people are familiar with it. But as New Mexico is particularly susceptible to rapid warming, I think it's a really important conference for us all to attend.
Very much so. I mean, I think that one of the things that is happening is that a lot of boundaries are breaking down. So basically, your average, ordinary person really is getting something out of going to a Bioneers conference, which may have been earlier more for people who were involved in conservation work or whatever. Now it's for everybody. And just likewise in the CCA, you are doing art, films, lectures, ecology, and all sorts of things, and really bringing them together.
Right, and I think that's the interdisciplinary future that we're looking at. These kind of categories or these pigeonholes that we're so used to dealing with just are not a way, it's not a way to move forward. And we really need to be all working together, and the lines aren't clearly drawn in the sand anymore, but they are, these things are urgent. So it's great to have these visionaries that are really creating a kind of a healthy and diverse picture of the future that we can work toward in a hopeful way, because so often we're bogged down in the tragedy of it all, and it's great to see people actually forging ahead. And people also like John Fogarty, who, you know, is just doing really amazing, hopeful work, because if we can't map a hopeful future, then we won't have one.
Now tell us what John Fogarty, he's the director of the New Energy Economy, mm-hmm. is doing. He will be at the CCA tomorrow night.
Right. He's going to speak around 6, we think. The work that John and I have come up with for this show has been very casual in nature. It really came from a quick conversation over brunch about, wouldn't it be great to ask people where their electricity came from and how they would hope to see their electricity come from. So he and I created this idea of a video booth, and so we're actually asking people that attend the opening to give us their 15 seconds on where they think their electricity comes from and where they would hope that it comes from in the future. And he's also been out, or actually his people from New Energy Economy have been out all week with CCA people interviewing on the streets and asking people exactly that question. So we'll also be showing an edited version of the responses that we've had so far.
Very, very interesting. Leah Recco is director of the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe, curator of Mapping a Green Future, which opens tomorrow, Friday, at 5 in the afternoon. And for more information, people can go to ccasantafe.org or call 982-1338. Leah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and the podcast site where you can hear the show whenever you like is santafe.radiocafe.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month Keith Jarrett. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company tomorrow, Robert Knott, and much, much more. Hasta la vista. Ciao.